Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So the poor are still being sent unjustly into prison. In Honduras, in the place where the prison fire happened last month in Comayagua, a majority of the prisoners had never been to trial. So they were just being held there, some of them for years on end.
That's the voice of author Dr. Adrian Pine. On this week's show, we speak to Adrian about the ongoing repression in Honduras, the criminalization of the poor, and how the poor people led by the women are starting to reject this notion. So stay tuned.
We are very privileged this morning to be joined by Dr. Adrian Pine. She is professor at the American University. She's also the author of many books. Her latest book, Working Hard, Drinking Hard, on Violence and Survival in Honduras. Very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start by maybe inviting you to paint a picture and tell us what inspired the title of your book and to write this book.
The title, Working Hard, Drinking Hard, on Violence and Survival in Honduras. What inspired me to write it is, I guess that's a longer story. I had started out being with a strong interest in the maquiladora industry, which is the sweatshop industry that produces so much of our clothing in the United States. And I had really been focusing on abuses in that industry, which is something that I think a lot of young college students and graduate students become interested in as they discover that their school clothing is made, you know, in horrible conditions in countries where there's more oppression than we're used to experiencing on a daily basis in the United States. So I started looking into work in that sense. But what I found was that, first of all, in Honduras, people weren't as concerned about the abuses in the factories as they were about other kinds of violence. And secondly, what I determined from that in my analysis was that although the abuses in the factories were very bad, the way that that society managed to frame violence as being something that happened outside of the factory meant that that those abuses in the factory went largely unnoticed and didn't have a lot of attention paid to them. I think working hard, the focus on working hard in the title is to emphasize the fact that that Hondurans, like many people in majority poor areas, do work very, very hard, and yet in contrast to the Protestant ethic, which tells us that if we work hard, then we will succeed, they find that they're working very hard, but they're ending up in very bad circumstances, and that's through no fault of their own, but rather because they're in an unjust economic situation. And this is, of course, all prior to the coup that took place in 2009.
I'm so glad that you point out that our framing, how we look at the world, impacts the way we understand the world and the assumptions we make of that world. As you point out, most people who live in poor countries are presumed to be the cause of their own conditions. And when we think about the work and how work is conceptualized within a capitalist economy, it's a mechanical process, right? We simply become cogs in that machinery that produces commodities or produces whatever it is we're buying and selling. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that notion, because both in North America and in many parts of the world, the poor, instead of looking at the root causes of their poverty, are simply pathologizing that they're either sick, you know, they're drunks or addicts, or they're criminalized as the perennial deviant, right? The people who don't obey the laws and don't play by the rules. Can you talk a little bit about this and the impact that this has not only in our ability to unite and create or imagine a different kind of society.
Absolutely. That was actually, as you know, one of the primary focuses of or foci of my book. I was interested in why the poor ended up being blamed so often for problems that, in my analysis, were caused by structural violence and agents that included the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and a state that was looking out for the interests of the wealthy and represented the very wealthy to the exclusion of the poor. And what I found was that indeed the poor were pathologized. They were blamed. And I looked specifically at pathologization through the language and practices of alcoholism and in particular of Alcoholics Anonymous in Honduras, which functions, although it's supposedly a universal program, I found that it had some real specificities in Honduras, one of those being that that it was not at all anonymous, that everybody knew who everybody else was in the program, and that tied to that, it was really only poor people who participated in Alcoholics Anonymous because that was the only real avenue they had for healing besides healing through evangelical church experiences, which also occurs, of course. And what I found was that the discourse and practice of Alcoholics Anonymous really really encouraged the poor people who were identified as alcoholics, which also meant that in society people thought that alcoholism or think that alcoholism is really a trait of the poor rather than the other ways that it is sometimes conceptualized in other places. But it meant that trying to get oneself out of the identity of being an alcoholic meant acting in a higher social status. So trying to speak in a language that sounded more bourgeois, trying to dress in a way that looked nicer, so that all of this was wrapped up. The idea of being an alcoholic was wrapped up with the idea of being poor. And, of course, alcoholic is considered a morally pathologized category in Honduras, despite the fact that, you know, there's contradictory ideas within the doctrine of Alcoholics Anonymous about, first of all, it's a disease, but it's also something that you can cure through your relationship with God, and people were considered themselves not at fault because it was a disease, but they also were at fault if they didn't take the responsibility to cure it. So it became a sort of individualized pathology of the poor, not just alcoholics, but of the poor who are thought of as alcoholics. I don't know if I'm making myself clear there, but there are a whole bunch of labels, negative labels, that are put on the poor that include alcoholics, vagrants, gang members, and the latter, the gang members, is one that was particularly used in the early decade of the 2000s to actually criminalize the poor. And this happened through a program, a policing program called Mano Dura, which was actually imported by Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, who has consulted throughout Latin America and has promoted these get tough on crime policies that basically criminalize poverty. In other words, an anti-gang law was passed in 2003 by the current president of Honduras, Pepe Lobo, when he was president of the Congress, that made it a crime to have a series of identities, and those could be associating with a gang regardless of any violent act committed, having a tattoo, wearing gang clothing, having friends who are in a gang, and all of these identities that became labeled as crimes were identities that for many poor people in Honduras were impossible to avoid. If you live in an area that has gangs, it's impossible for you to not know people who are in gangs, and therefore criminalize the whole sector of society, and justified this scapegoating of the poor to the exclusion of recognizing the violence of the wealthy.
That's such an important point because while most people in North America may not be aware of the military coup that took place in 2009, this event has completely transformed the lives of people in Honduras, and not in a positive way. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the link between the increase in violence from the state against the population and this move to criminalize the poverty of people and this move to individualize the problem instead of looking at the systemic problems of exploitation and the kinds of very corrosive mining industry that is promoted as development in the area.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really important question to look at in the context of the coup. The writing that I did in my book about the criminalization of poverty was focused on field work that took place in the early 2000s, in the early part of the decade. So it was very interesting to see that after the coup, there was a real shift in the way people understood violence. There were a lot of different popular sayings that grew out of the coup of people saying the masks had come off and that now they recognized the people who they had always thought were their allies were actually carrying out violence against them. That is people in the Senate, people in the Honduran Congress. So there was a shift at that point from the poor blaming themselves to the majority poor, and, you know, Honduras is a country that's vastly majority poor, blaming what they call the oligarchy of Honduras, recognizing that this is violence that's being carried out against them by a class of wealthy people that does not share any of the gains that they make, of the economic or social gains that they've made from exploiting the poor. And so the discourse really shifted in the 2 years following the coup, where people stopped buying into the logic of the criminalization of the poor. And there's been a real retrenchment on the part of the people who carried out the coup of those logics to try to revert to a place where poor people will once again blame themselves for what has been a vast amount of state violence following the coup, for which there's never been any resolution. It's important to point out there was an election, but it was held under military rule. It was very poorly voted, and it was considered fraudulent by a large number of Hondurans, so that the current president has no mandate. And then also, it's important to mention that there's been impunity for all of the crimes committed during the coup, and even in the first 6 months, there were over 4,000 documented human rights violations, including targeted assassinations, a lot of torture, and there's been impunity for all of that. So there's been no resolution to the coup, and targeted assassinations have continued, carried out by state security forces. And along with this atmosphere of impunity, what we've seen is that Honduras has risen to the shameful position of the most violent country in the world. This is according to UN statistics that have Honduras now at a statistic of 82 per 100,000 murders, that is per 100,000 population. So we have this incredible violence and the people in power trying to convince the poor that it's their own culture, that it's their own fault, and people aren't buying it in the way that they did 10 years ago. So I think that's an improvement, and that has to do with the fact that after the coup, there was a resistance movement that sprung up and that really, really changed the dialogue in Honduras.
Well, I agree with you that people are growing in their awareness of the inequality and the relationships of power, the shape, not just their lives, but the institutions, the governance, right? At the same time, I see a move to reinforce the tools of oppression, you know, the prison system throughout the United States and now increasingly in Canada has become a very good tool to make malleable subjects, to make populations conform to very unjust policies of austerity, of cuts to social spending, to increase military spending. All of these things we are told are things we need. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the prison system and how it has served in that particular area to continuously force the population to conform to inequitable policies of, you know, trade agreements or development as they conceive it in the form of mining or maquilas or the kinds of exploitative practices that have been ongoing for decades now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Honduras, especially with the prison fire that took place a month and a couple days ago in Honduras, that killed 300 or over 360 people, is one of the worst examples of the prison industrial complex. I think that, you know, whereas in the United States, what we've basically done is incarcerated, you know, the young black men as a whole, in Honduras, that is being carried out in a somewhat less racialized fashion, but definitely a targeted class, which is young poor men. And there was the criminalization of poverty, which didn't let up. I did mention, you know, that people aren't buying it as much anymore, but that doesn't mean that it's let up at all. So the poor are still being sent unjustly into prison. In Honduras, in the place where the prison fire happened last month in Comayagua, a majority of the prisoners had never been to trial. So they were just being held there, some of them for years on end. And then in addition to the criminalization of poverty, you mentioned the mines and the other exploitative industry. Following the coup, there's been a criminalization of resistance, a criminalization of dissent, which took place in a modified anti-gang law, which is called the anti-terrorist law. So now people who defend their rights are being defined as terrorists, whether those are rights to have a community free of mines and the toxins and violence that come along with them, or a community that wants to retain its land so that it can sustain itself. There are many people who are being thrown into jail without any due process, and then in some cases, like the case last month, being killed en masse, because that's what the penitentiary system in Honduras allows for. I think Honduras is a really extreme example of the exact same logics that we have in the United States and Canada, which are really directly attacking any notion of participatory democracy by removing quote-unquote dangerous elements from society. And the reason that these people are dangerous is that they're dangerous to the accumulation of capital because they represent a democratic voice that would speak otherwise.
In spite of the violence that we face, people worldwide are resisting the policies of inequality imposed by neoliberalism, imposed by austerity measures, imposed by minimum sentence policies. What can we learn from the resistance movement in Honduras, where, in my opinion, women are integral participants?
Yeah, the resistance movement, for me and for many others, first of all, came as a real surprise. I think that a lot of us, having watched Honduras and lived in Honduras for many years, you know, the question has always been, since the 80s, why didn't Honduras stand up like other countries in Central America did? And this really gave us an answer that Honduras could resist. And I think the women's leadership in the resistance movement was particularly poignant because women brought in an analysis, and feminists brought in an analysis that had been lacking previously. So there was one chant that was very popular in marches that was ni golpes al Estado, ni golpes a las mujeres. Golpe is the word for both for coup and for a blow or a punch. And so what they were saying is that, you know, we will not stand for coups, nor will we stand for women being hit. And they were talking about or bringing together those two acts of violence in really important ways. And it's true that the coup is the most anti-woman, anti-gay, misogynist thing that could possibly have happened. Just in a few days, the president of the Congress, if he hasn't already, was going to sign the most sweeping legislation against contraception that we've seen in any of these countries. the coup was a real blow to women's rights, but at the same time, the resistance movement brought an entirely new language to leftist mobilization in Honduras, so that now whenever anything is being organized, any movement, whether we're talking about land rights or anti-mining, it's clear to people that women have to be a central part of it, and not just in a sort of ancillary way, not just in language, but women have taken on leadership roles in resisting that I think has made that resistance a lot more poignant and has made it possible for there to be spaces of contestation internationally like we're seeing now. Just last week, a letter was sent from the Congress, from 94 Congress members in the United States to Hillary Clinton, demanding an end to military aid, while the kind of human rights violations that specifically target workers, but also women activists and LGBT activists. So, you know, I think that women have played a very strong role in the resistance movement, and they've enabled a language and an analysis that wasn't really prevalent before the coup to be prevalent today and to really help the resistance movement to continue thriving in different ways.
In my opinion, our struggles are interconnected and interrelated. If there is injustice in Honduras, it allows for a naturalization of that violence to continue to be perpetrated on people everywhere else. What would you say are to be our united front against the violence that we see in Honduras, and how should people perhaps reimagine our actions in the face of this violence?
Well, I think it's really important for people to start at home if they want to be working in solidarity with Hondurans who are in resistance to primarily the violence of transnational capital. So for Canadians, that means in particular looking at the violence of the Canadian Free Trade Agreement with Honduras, and especially the mining industry, which has caused so much violence to Hondurans and to which there is a great amount of resistance. In the United States, there are so many ways that the United States has supported the coup. There are so many ways that the U.S. government has continued to support the violence being carried out against Honduran people. And, you know, if we value Honduran democracy, we need to fight for democracy in our own countries so that we can say as citizens, no, we want to put a stop to this violence, which is supporting these multinational corporations that don't give back to our countries and that are causing such violence to people in Honduras.
Thank you so much for being with us. Tell our audience so they can access your book, Working Hard, Drinking Hard, on Violence and Survival in Honduras.
Well, the book is available on any of the retail sites, Powell's or Amazon, but anyone can also go to my blog, and there's a link to it there. My blog is quotha.net. That's quotha.net.
Wonderful. Thank you again for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care. That was Dr. Adrienne Pine. We reached her in Honduras.
We ask God's comfort for those who mourn today.
We'll never know how many Iraqis have died since these days. The
impact of the invasion on the civilian population.
Welcome American troops.
We hold the occupation troops responsible.
These airstrikes are so imprecise that it's that's leading to the excess deaths of women.
And the American people aren't seeing the real war, what's really happening.
Total disregard for human life.
It's entirely politicized.
Now, I mean, I've seen innocent people being killed.
But in terms of the overall strategy, we're just in the beginning phases.
I scraped dead bodies off the pavement with a shovel and threw them in trash bags.
In our efforts to make the world more peaceful,
500,000 deaths.
Operation Iraqi Freedom, freedom, freedom.
Things that our unit did in Iraq, killing civilians.
Oh,
That is the incredible lyrics and music of Peyote for President. And I think the melody and the song speaks to this constant myth we are told that governments are acting on our interests, that governments are respecting the rights of people, and the many multiple wars that are being fought today are being done for democracy, to create a world that's democratic and inclusive, respectful of people's rights.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.